From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made on a ski trip. Months prior, a woman named Pamela had broken her ankle and leg, and she'd been forced to live a sedentary lifestyle. And when she healed, she went on that yearly ski vacation. During the trip, she noticed that she was unusually out of breath, and it wasn't due to the altitude change. Something was wrong. Thinking she might have a blockage, Pamela made an appointment with a cardiologist. There were no issues with her arteries. She had been treated for hypertension for several years and had gained some weight. Her lipid levels had also changed. With those three conditions in mind, a doctor diagnosed her with metabolic syndrome. Metabolic syndrome is a cluster of conditions like those Pamela was experiencing. A patient is diagnosed with the syndrome when they have three or more conditions. The syndrome can lead to chronic issues such as heart disease, brain disease, diabetes. According to a study published by JAMA in 2020, as many as 37% of Americans have metabolic syndrome, but many of us have never heard of it. The good news is that metabolic syndrome can be reversed with lifestyle changes. That has been what's happened for Pamela, who changed her diet, committed to regular exercise. We'll hear her story this hour, and we'll talk about local and national efforts to learn more about the syndrome and to prevent it. RIT has a key role in those efforts. We're going to talk about that. I'd like to welcome our guest now. Pamela Rohde is the patient who successfully reversed her metabolic syndrome through lifestyle changes. Pamela, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
It's nice to have you. It's nice to have Barbara Losey, who is a professor of health sciences and head of the Wegman School of Health and Nutrition, director of the NEED Center at RIT. Barbara, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Evan. It's nice to talk with you.
And Linda Powell is the Charles J. and Margaret Roberts Professor of Preventive Medicine and Chairperson of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Rush Medical College in Chicago. Linda, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And Linda, you're the principal investigator of the ELM clinical trial. Is that right?
That's correct.
Nice to have you. We'll be talking about that. I want to make sure we understand Pamela's story here. I mean, Pamela, before all of this happened, had you ever heard of metabolic syndrome?
No, I really hadn't. I'm a nurse, but dealt with diabetes a lot, but not metabolic syndrome.
So take us through that time in your life. Now, how far back are we going here?
Well, I broke my ankle and leg just before COVID. So it was probably 2018, 2019.
Okay. And when you broke your ankle, you know, we tried to kind of condense the story a little bit, but take us through the story. What happens then?
So I was, I had to have surgery and have pins and was off my ankle and leg for 6 weeks to 6 to 8 weeks. It healed, but it's hard to recover from an ankle surgery anyway. And so I'd been active before, but got used to having things taken care of for me. So I was a little bit lazy, to say the least, after that.
Okay. And then when did you really think, though, that something beyond a normal issue was happening to you?
Well, when we went skiing and I could not get my breath. And it usually takes a day or two before the altitude goes away, the altitude sickness or shortness of breath, and I really couldn't do it. And it made me concerned that I had some kind of heart problems with that.
I mean, I'm sure that's a frightening moment, but I know a lot of people who it takes a lot to get them to go see a doctor. How soon did you decide you had to get checked out?
I would say I called my doctor probably in March. We ski in February, so in March I called her to see if I could get an appointment with a cardiologist. I have a history, my family has a history of having heart blockages, mother and sister and brother, so I was kind of concerned that this might be a problem.
But that wasn't the issue, right? I mean, the arteries were okay?
Yeah, they were. I had all the tests done, and they said, no, your heart's good. And so that made me think there's got to be another problem.
See,
maybe I need to lose weight.
Yeah, I mean, Pamela, at that moment, I wonder if it's a relief that they come back and say, no, I mean, your arteries are good, your heart's good. But you know something is wrong.
Oh, yeah, it was a big relief.
Yeah, so that's a relief, sure. But, I mean, it must be confusing to know that something is wrong.
Right.
And, you know, a friend of mine who is a doctor told me once, he said, you know, a lot of patients want to go see a doctor and have the doctor tell them exactly what's up. I mean, and if you got a broken bone or a tumor, they can often do that. But sometimes it's the elimination of possibilities and then sort of piecing together with different clues. And it doesn't happen right away. Were you frustrated that you didn't feel like you had an answer, or did you feel like you were at least on the right track there?
No, I was not frustrated. I felt like I needed to make some changes. But, and, you know, I just did labs, and so she's actually the one that identified the fact that I had metabolic syndrome. And but I didn't know where to go, you know, how to do it. I mean, as I should know. I know good nutrition. I know I should exercise, but it just stuff wasn't working.
Okay. What was your process to go through to make sure you did feel like you had the right approach then?
Well, I got a call from the Elm program at Rush from wanted to see. Must have been referred by the cardiologist, and I qualified to participate in the program, and it got me started, and I was it helped a lot with encouraging and group participation, trying to get some changes in my lifestyle.
So they reached out to you. So you find out that Rush Medical College in Chicago, and you find out about the ELM clinical trial. And and Linda Paula, was it as simple as that for someone like Pamela? She's in. She's got the diagnosis. She can be part of it.
Sure. What we're looking for is people who are screening in on the metabolic syndrome. So we do an evaluation based on blood work and on physical measures. And then we ask people, you know, are you really motivated to consider changing your lifestyle? So ELM is not about diets. If a person wants to lose weight because they want to fit into their dress for their daughter's wedding, they should be on a diet. But we're not about diets. We're about lifestyle. We're about looking at all of the aspects of your lifestyle and making some small changes that would help prevent the progression of the metabolic syndrome. What Pam is saying is absolutely right, that, you know, she was happy that she didn't have blockage in her coronary arteries. But when you have the metabolic syndrome, it's a warning sign. And it's saying if you don't do something, you ultimately could end up with a blockage in your arteries. So in a sense, this is a really good example of a preventive measure, preventing people from developing some kind of a clinical outcome.
Barbara Loza, can we get a definition, best you can give it to us, of metabolic syndrome?
Metabolic syndrome is a mosaic. It is a combination of problems that, when they're together, they're much worse than just very individual problems. So if you have high blood pressure and obesity or high waist circumference, and say low HDL, low good cholesterol, it's synergistic. It's even worse than just having high blood pressure, and so it leads to, like Dr. Paul said, it leads to lots of other things later on. And so let's bust it up. Let's stop it from happening so that we don't get some of those problems later on, such as strokes, such as heart disease.
Dr. Paul, can you elaborate a little bit on when you've got multiple risk factors? And is it as simple as looking at a list saying, well, here's a list of 5 possible, 7 possible, 8 possible, and if you've got 3 or more, you're on it? Or is it more technical than that?
No, it's a little bit more specific. So there are 5 risk factors that are part of the diagnosis of the metabolic syndrome. One is, as Barbara said, a large waist. So this is often the first thing we see in people. And that is, instead of just gaining weight overall, they're gaining weight in their waist. And that is the concept of apples versus pears. If you carry the weight in your thighs,
that's not part of the metabolic syndrome. But if you're carrying it in your waist, that's one of the things that we look for as a diagnosis. And in men, it's about a waist circumference of 40 inches or more. And in women, it's about 35 inches or more. The second one is triglycerides. It's a measure of, it's a general measure of how much fat you have in your diet. The third one is HDL, which is the good cholesterol. If that's lower than optimum, then that's another characteristic for diagnosing the metabolic syndrome. The fourth is blood pressure, either elevated systolic or elevated diastolic blood pressure. And the fifth is elevated blood sugar. So the blood pressure is primarily a function of weight, how much weight you're carrying around, and salt intake. And blood sugar is highly related to how much of your diet is comprised of carbohydrates. So when you have three of those, then we diagnose the metabolic syndrome. Metabolism is the underlying biochemical processes that sustain life. And we call it the metabolic syndrome, which I think is a really hard term for people to understand. It's the metabolism, the underlying biochemical processes, and the syndrome, because once you get one of these five characteristics, you're traveling down the path to get a second one and a third one and a fourth one. And that means you're traveling down the path for some kind of clinical event. It affects the heart. It affects diabetes. It affects the length of your life. It affects cancer. It affects the brain and is associated with cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And more recently, since we're you know, dealing with this pandemic, we've realized that one of the big risk factors for severity of infection and hospitalizations from COVID is, guess what? The metabolic syndrome. It's a state of low-level inflammation. The body is out of balance. And the body is essentially, it's not telling you because the symptoms are silent, but essentially what's happening is you're out of balance and you're traveling toward clinical events.
Dr. Powell, is there a specific reason that an accumulation of stomach fat or fat in the belly is going to be more of a problem? I mean, you know, I think everybody has sort of a tendency, or at least I think, whereas if you, you know, if you're not working out, if you're not eating very well, and you put on 2, 3, 5, 10 pounds, people probably know where they are likely to gain the weight. And for some people, you're right, it's thighs, legs. Some people, it's more around the midsection. Is there a reason that the stomach, the accumulation of stomach is more concerning?
So there are different kinds of fat. Fat in the thighs is a passive storage depot. But when you have fat around the midsection, that's a part of the brain metabolism network. And what happens is when you have a great deal of fat, it puts pressure on some of the internal organs that speed up metabolism adversely affects it. So when you think about belly fat or beer bellies or apples or any of that, you have to think about that as not a passive storage depot, but an active type of fat that adversely influences the metabolic processes.
Okay. Interesting. Boy, that's amazing what we learn about our bodies. And
yeah.
and Dr. Powell, is that general idea right, that most people will... is it a matter of luck that if people tend to gain weight, they gain it in one place or another, and it may not be the belly for some and it's the belly for others? Or are there other factors in play as to how we gain the weight?
I think that's a question that we're worrying about right now, like who is more inclined to develop, we call it central adiposity or central fat versus peripheral fat. We know that there are different functions of these different kinds of fat, but in terms of is there genetic predisposition to accumulate fat peripherally versus centrally, we're not sure about that. But we do know one thing that's really important, and it's important for the topics that we're talking about today, and that is the accumulation of central fat is a function of a sedentary lifestyle. is a function of stress and is a function of the kind of diet that you eat. There is fundamental agreement across all different kinds of specialties within science and medicine that the fundamental cause of central fat are those three things: diet, physical activity, and stress.
One more point for Dr. Paul, and then we're going to kind of come back to who's most at risk, how you identify, you know what Pamela has had to do and how it's going, and what Barbara and her colleagues maybe help people with here. But I just want to hit the dementia point one more time. Researchers in Korea, for example, have found that the more severe the metabolic syndrome is, the higher the risk of dementia. And severe metabolic syndrome increases the risk of dementia 2.62 times. That's just not something I think most people would ever connect unless, you know, they're hearing a program like this or they end up encountering metabolic syndrome in their own lives. I never, Dr. Paul, would have connected those things.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying is we haven't really understood the metabolic syndrome from the point of view that it is a multi-system disorder. So when the biochemical processes that we can't see, but that are going on internally, get out of balance, it has an effect on everything. And some of the most recent research is looking at the brain, the impact on the brain. So it's related to Alzheimer's disease. It's related to dementia. It's related to cognitive decline. And then even more recently than that, we're realizing that people who end up in the hospital after infection from COVID have a high rate of metabolic syndrome. So we have to think about it as a warning sign. It's a state of biochemical abnormalities that's a warning sign that's going to have implications for all of the systems. And the problem with medical practice is people, once they have a problem with one of these systems, they go to medical practice. And then the treatment is for the particular system that's been affected. But if we take steps backwards and say, well, what caused that? We get to the metabolic syndrome and we see that there are these syndrome of symptoms of imbalance that are the problem. And then you go even back farther from that and you get to lifestyle. And so what the problem is that we're trying to solve with this trial is that if a patient wants to go to clinical practice, they go to their primary care doc or their cardiologist and say, hey, I have the metabolic syndrome. Is lifestyle related to that? Chances are the primary care doc will say yes. And then if the patient says, well, what can I do? I don't really want to go on drugs because clinical practice right now is focused on taking each piece of the metabolic syndrome and treating them with drugs. But a lot of patients don't want to go on drugs. 50% of the patients that are prescribed drugs across all drug classes don't take them as prescribed. So within the other 50% within that 50% that aren't taking drugs, what options do we have for them if they want to undergo a lifestyle program? And the reason we're doing this trial is because there aren't a lot of options for people like Pam. Pam has decided that she wants to try making changes in her lifestyle. So what do we have in clinical practice for that? And the answer is not very much. And that's what this trial is aimed at trying to fix.
How does the trial work?
So we maybe I'll let Barbara say that. Barbara is she probably is our best PI of five different sites. And she is really incredibly accomplished. So I'm going to punt that to Barbara.
Okay, Barbara.
You're going to pass that off. First of all, I thought it was very interesting when Pamela made the statement that she knew about good nutrition. She knew exercise was important, but she didn't really know what to do. And so, you know, this isn't really rocket science. We all know that eating well is good. We all know that we need to be physically active. But how do you put that into practice? And like Dr. Paul said, how do you make it a lifestyle change? That's what the trial is really about. And just so you know, this is a nationwide trial. There are five different sites. And Rochester is one of the sites, as is Chicago and Denver, Geisinger Clinic, and University of Missouri, Kansas City Medical Center in Kansas City.
So we're doing this study not just with one particular group of people or in one particular geographic region, but what we're looking at is, because we all know that nutrition and exercise and stress reduction are important, we're wanting to know, what's the best way to get this information to people? And what's the best way to implement this? Because, sometimes things cost more, sometimes they're more expensive. When you're doing things as a group or when you're just doing it yourself, sometimes you're better off being motivated yourself. Sometimes you need to do things in a group. And so our trial is a clinically randomized trial, which is the gold standard of research design. It's a clinical trial. It's randomized. And what people do is contact us, and we do a nice assessment to see, first of all, does the person have metabolic syndrome? That in and of itself is really helpful to people, for them to know whether or not they have metabolic syndrome. And that requires a physical exam and a blood sample. And that's all done, absolutely no cost to a participant at all. And then if they have the metabolic syndrome and are interested in participating, they are randomized to one of two groups. One group gets all kinds of material and information and has access to web material. They have actually a Fitbit that they get. There's a person that they can call, they can contact, but it's much more self-directed. The other group is intensive group-based sessions. In fact, for about 3 months, they meet every week. Currently in Rochester, our meetings are at the Henrietta Parks and Rec in the Bushman Log Cabin. And they meet, and there's cooking demonstrations, there's group discussion, there's relaxation. They go for a walk, they do some activity. And so you are randomly assigned to one of these groups. Nobody, it's all random. Nobody has, in fact, I will tell you that I have absolutely no idea who's in which group. It's blinded. So that, and the people who do assessments are all blinded. But so everybody gets some sort of treatment. Everybody gets some help. And we're wanting to know, which is the best way to get help? Because we do know that treatment really does work. We do know that if people are able to go through a lifestyle change program, they really do decrease. In fact, they end up not having a diagnosis of metabolic syndrome. And that's wonderful. You actually reverse your health status so that you no longer can say, I have metabolic syndrome. So our study is trying to look at which is the best way. And so after people are in a group, people are in the study for 2 years. The group sessions meet weekly for the first 3 months, and then they meet every other week for the next 3 months. So that after 6 months, they've had this pretty intensive group. And then there's a maintenance session where you meet every single month. And so a person signs up, they're in the study for 2 years, and we're following them this whole time, doing assessments at different time points. People are, they get some type of financial incentive to be able to participate in the assessments. But we aren't questioning, our question isn't, does lifestyle change work? We know it works. Our question is, what is the best way to get this help to people? Is it better to do it in a self-directed, little less intense way? Or do we really need to have this level of intensity where we have lots of personal interaction? And that's what we're trying to answer.
What are you finding out so far?
Well, I can honestly tell you that I can't answer that question because I'm blinded. And Dr.
We're all blinded. We're all blind.
We can't wait until we can actually find out.
We're doing good science here. And when Barbara said we're randomizing, that means people don't have a choice. They can't choose to be in the self-directed or the group-based arm. And that's because we know that if people made that choice, for example, if people made the choice to go into the group, there's a chance that they will be similar on other characteristics. So what if all the people who chose to be in the group were women, and many of the people who chose to be in self-directed were men? Then when all is said and done, and we try to compare the two arms, we're not only comparing the effectiveness of treatment, but whether the but we're comparing by gender, we're comparing women versus men. So we have to randomize in order to create equality of the groups on all of these other characteristics that people will bring to them. So that's good science. And then the other part of good science that we were just talking about is staying unaware until the entire trial is over of how it's going. Because if we knew, say we knew that the self-directed arm was much, much better than the group-based arm, then that would influence the participants' enthusiasm for continuing. It would influence the investigators' enthusiasm for keeping it going for a long period of time. So the way you do a clinical trial is everybody remains blinded to the outcome until the very end of the trial, and then we go to what we call unblinding sessions, and everybody finds out what happened. I think the third thing that go ahead, Linda. Okay, is the question is not about can we change lifestyle. The question is, can we help people make a permanent change in their lifestyle? So we can help people make short-term changes in pretty much any area that we're working on. We can help them lose weight. We can help them stop smoking. We can help them pretty much do anything. But the challenge is, can we do something that will help people make a change that's not short-term, but that continues for the rest of their lives? And that's why the study is a 2-year study, because we're not asking about short-term change. We're saying, can we put people into these programs and have them help them realize that living a healthy lifestyle really is not about eating carrots and working out 80% maximum capacity on treadmills most days. It's not about that. That's deprivation. But what our program is about is coming back and enjoying life doing things like taking regular walks and eating more vegetables and being mindful about the kinds of things that we eat. Those are all they're simple changes to make, and they're easy to make. And those are the things that we're trying to have an impact on to get to this, to the Holy Grail. And the Holy Grail is, can we help people make a permanent change in their lifestyle? They enjoy the new way of being so much better. They don't want to go back to the old way.
When you say eating carrots, getting on a treadmill, that can be deprivation to some people. I mean, I would argue that some people like that, but I think what I'm hearing, and tell me if this is correct, Dr. Pa, what I think I'm hearing is that if people perceive a corrective action to be deprivation, that will almost inevitably run its course, and that'll be viewed as a short-term fix as opposed to something that can become a rhythm of life that lasts long-term or indefinitely.
Very well said. Yeah. I mean, think about you buy a new exercise bike, and everything is really great. You know, it's down in your playroom, and you're working out on it every day, and then after about a month or two, it starts becoming a place to hang clothes on. Okay, that's the problem. You know, there's a lot of enthusiasm in the short term, but what happens over time is there's a waning of enthusiasm, and people revert right back to the way they were before.
Well, after we take our only break of the hour, I want to ask Pamela Rohde about making lasting changes, not just sort of the short term or just counting calories or getting on a treadmill, but what can you do that says, I can do this, and I want to do this, and I want to keep doing this. When we come back, we'll talk to Pamela Rohde about that. She's a patient who is working on and has been reversing her metabolic syndrome through lifestyle changes. Barbara Losey is a professor of health sciences and head of the Wegman School of Health and Nutrition and director of the Need Center at RIT. And Dr. Linda Powell is the Charles J. and Margaret Roberts Professor of Preventive Medicine and chairperson of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Rush Medical College in Chicago. Let's take that break, and we'll come back and talk about it next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, Todd Moss joins us, a former Deputy Secretary of State for Africa, serving a number of years in the Bush administration. Todd Moss is a Pittsford graduate, and he's got perspective on how the State Department and how foreign policy is run. especially in light of what happened in Afghanistan. Todd Moss, Thursday.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Pamela Rohde told her story earlier this hour of being diagnosed with metabolic syndrome. And now the question becomes, how do you make a change that becomes permanent? So, Pamela, can you take me through what you've been learning throughout this process and maybe what's changed for you?
So, I've changed kind of my own way of looking at food and pay more attention to labels and see what the number of servings are and what the calories are. Not as much calories as, you know, how much is one serving, and even having potato chips, you know, it says, can you eat 30 potato chips is one serving. Okay, that's all I need. So, and also I've looked at exercise a little bit differently, not just on the treadmill or whatever. And in fact, during COVID, a lot of people were complaining that they'd gained a bunch of weight, but thank God I was in the program with Elm. I was able to lose weight during COVID just because I got out and walked every day, tried to make my steps 10,000 steps a day, if not more. And that's what the Fitbit helped a lot of identifying, getting up at least 10, 12 times a day. Don't sit in your chair for an hour and not do anything. And looking at what I'm eating for a meal and making at least a half of a plate of vegetables, which, you know, when you used to look at food, or when I'd feed my kids, it was mostly starch and meat and not as much vegetables, because I was trying to keep things going and keep them healthy, but apparently I wasn't keeping healthy. So those are some big changes that I've made.
Do you feel like the changes for you are going to be easy to sustain, difficult to sustain? I mean, how do you describe it to people who might be wondering how durable these changes can be?
Well, it's easy to look at a plate of food. In fact, even when you go to a restaurant, sometimes I thought, oh, boy, we should put more vegetables on this plate. I should have a salad with this. I think it's easy. It actually even has changed my husband's food intake, and he's lost weight with me just because we've just made some changes and gotten more exercise. You know, regularly, not just every hour, you know, once a week or so, go to the gym or something. In fact, we don't have gym membership. We just use what we have at home, whatever we do.
Yeah, well,
try to do it at least 30 minutes a day, maybe 15 minutes here and there, but at least 30 minutes a day for exercise.
Well, let me ask Barbara and Linda about that. So, Barbara, first of all, how's that sound to you?
Yeah, it sounds to me like she's taking it a little bit at a time. She's also not just focusing on the nutrition or just the exercise. It's a group thing. You needing to look at all sorts of different things. And I also like the fact that Pamela mentioned about safety, because that's a real concern of ours in the Elm trial. You know, with COVID, you know, we've been following every single recommendation that is required to be safe during the COVID pandemic. We also have a physician on our team, and there is a data safety monitoring board that actually looks at the study itself. We have people who work in our intervention who are dietitians, they're psychologists, they're emergency medical technicians. So there's a lot of attention paid to safety, and I think that what Pamela has been talking about is she's doing things a little bit at a time and not
just going in and trying to make tons and tons and tons of changes. She's really looking at her entire lifestyle.
Dr. Powell, what do you think of what you're hearing so far here?
I loved what she said about it's easy. You see, that's what we're trying to get to. We're trying to get people to try new things until they become habitual. And if they do them enough, what we know about habit formation is if you keep doing something new regularly, then it becomes a new habit. And when Pam says it's easy, she's saying, you know, we're not having to count every single calorie that comes in. We just have these habits that we're trying out, and they're easy things to do. Taking a walk with her husband on most days for 30 minutes before dinner, after dinner, that's easy, you know, and that's what it's about. It's just, and when she says it's easy, what she's telling us is that I'm not trying as hard as I possibly can to do something new, and I'm really trying really hard, because when they say that, then we know that that is the kind of behavior that is unlikely to be sustained over time. But when she says it's easy, then we think, okay, it's easy and it's likely to be sustained. So everything that she's saying are things that we talk about in Elm. But the most important thing that she said is that it's easy, because that gives us hope for sustainability.
Okay. And you know, Dr. Paul, I think about people like my mother who, at one point in her life, she was making some pretty significant health changes. And I remember having a conversation, and she hadn't really done a whole lot of physical activity for a while. She had back and neck pain, and she was trying to feel better in that way. And she said, I need to just start walking. But she said, but that's not enough. I need to do more than walk. And we had a conversation about, you know, what you felt, you know, what she felt she could sustain and how you get into that. But she indicated that she really wanted to she wanted to quit smoking when her grandchildren were born. There were big changes that she wanted to make, even if they were hard, even if they were not easy. And so I guess what I'm curious to know is easy always the baseline? I mean, can people make these changes even when they are hard, or at least at the start of the mountain, they look up and go, this is not a mountain I particularly want to climb, but I will do it. Or is human nature telling us people don't sustain that?
Mm-hmm. It's never easy at the beginning. Trying something new it's always easy. You know, think about if you want to start jogging, you buy the jogging clothes and you buy your new jogging shoes and you go out, and the first day it's wonderful. You have a great time. And then you go out the second day and you realize you're beginning to get some pain, some muscle soreness. And by the third day, it's not easy anymore. And so that's the normal course of adopting a new behavior, that at the very beginning, it's really easy and it's fun and it's exciting. And then you continue going on and it gets hard. And that's when you have to use a lot of self-management strategies to keep going. But as you follow the process of change forward, you realize that the more you do it, the easier it becomes. So the goal is to get to easy. But you have to go through hard to get to easy.
Can you weigh in on that too, Barbara? I am curious to know how you feel about the mindset and the way that we approach these changes in our lives.
Yeah, I think that there are sometimes motivational aspects, like you were mentioning your mother wanted to stop smoking for her grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
Those are like little hooks to try to grab onto. Okay, that's something that's going to help motivate you. But then the steps of how you get from that motivational point, that teachable moment, so to speak, to actually integrating it into your lifestyle. So that's the really important part. And that's what actually we're working on in Elm, to help people take that motivation. People need to be motivated to even want to be in the Elm trial or to be in the Elm program. And usually there's something that is triggering them to make that happen. I think with Pamela not being able to breathe very easily, that was a real trigger for her. I want to change that. I want to stop that. And so usually there does have to be something that pushes you into it. And then that's when the steps, the training, the skills,
the factors that are going to help you to make this a lifelong change so that, like Dr. Paul says, it becomes much easier.
Pamela, how do you feel these days?
I feel really good. I've still kept the 20 pounds off that I need to, and that helps a lot, to say the least. And, you know, I regularly do exercise. It was a chore at first to do, you know, even attend the program. And once a week we had to get together. Actually, what was interesting in our program is that it was all online. Everything was Zoom-based. We did not meet anyone physically, basically because of COVID, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it easy to do that kind of program for me. And I think some other people did, too. And I'm happy with I keep looking at my weight, which I used to hate to even stand on the scale. So I'm happy with that. So I hope that it'll continue.
Well,
let me just say one other thing that's interesting about Pam's experience. She said that even my husband lost weight. And what mm-hmm. she's saying is that she had an impact on her social network. So we have a lot of friends and family members who are in our social network. But how many of all those people are really committed to health? And what we try to do is emphasize the importance of a health network, because we know that healthy and unhealthy behaviors travel in networks. Smoking travels in networks. Obesity travels in networks. Loneliness travels in networks. So the people that you're around and what they do influences what you do. And what Pam was saying, that her husband lost weight, is that she became a part of her husband's health network, because for him, being around Pam inspired him to be more like Pam and do what Pam was doing. So I think when we talk about motivation, we can't leave out the social side of this. And we have to keep in mind that if people are in networks that are large social networks, but nobody else is committed to maintaining a health or achieving a healthy lifestyle, then what they need to do is start thinking about who could be in their health network, who could be like them, and in the process of pursuing a healthy lifestyle. So the distinction between a social and a health network is important.
All right, let me get some feedback from listeners. Matt writes to say, I'm enjoying the show on metabolic syndrome. I missed part of the show, so let me just ask, in some ways, is metabolic syndrome just another way to describe middle age? Dr. Powell, let me ask all three of you. Dr. Powell, I'll start with you. Matt wants to know, are we just talking about middle age here?
You know, there is a new study that just came out that I'm fascinated by, and it's challenging the assumption that as we continue to age, our metabolism slows down. So we can't help but to gain weight as we continue to age. And that is now being debunked, and saying that metabolism really doesn't change until you're way beyond age 65. So I'd ask Matt, what else is changing with middle age? Is he, or does he observe people who are middle age slowing down and becoming more sedentary, spending more time eating processed foods that are ready to eat or foods that are ready to heat? You know, what's changing with midlife? Because we can't make the assumption that this is just a function of midlife. If there are people out there that are not also, if everybody in midlife doesn't have the metabolic syndrome, we have what we call in epidemiology an epidemic of the metabolic syndrome, because in the last 10 years, it's increased in the population from a quarter of the American adult population to a third of the American adult population. So it's increasing. It's a problem. Its function, its fundamental roots are lifestyle. But there are a whole bunch of people out there that still don't have the metabolic syndrome, and it is likely that those people are living a different kind of lifestyle than the people that do have the metabolic syndrome.
Mm-hmm. Barbara Losey, what do you think?
Yeah, I was going to say metabolic syndrome isn't selective to middle-aged people. There are very young people who have metabolic syndrome. Mm. There are people over the age of 80 that have metabolic syndrome. Men have it. Women have it. All, people in all different professions. It is not a selective disease for a particular gender, age group, economic level, or anything like that. So I would respectfully disagree with Matt and say that middle age can be a very wonderful time in life to be able to remain as healthy as at their when they were young.
Pamela, what would you say to Matt? He said he's been listening, very interesting, but is this just middle age? Did you think, you know, what's going on with me is just middle age? Are you there, Pamela? Might be muted. Don't have Pamela. See if we can get Pamela back here. And let me squeeze in a little bit of feedback. Let me squeeze in a little feedback for the end of the hour, too, on questions about study or at least getting in contact. So Eileen writes to say, Evan, how do I contact Dr. Powell or Barbara Losey regarding metabolic syndrome? Wondering just general information, but also about ongoing trials. Barbara, Dr.
Sure.
Powell?
Yeah, I have a phone number and an email that if you're interested, that here's the phone number. Can I give it now?
Yeah,
Evan?
Please do. Yep.
Okay. Well, it's the same. The 585 area code. And then the number is 484-7613.
Do it
That's
again.
585 area code, 484-7613. And there's an email that's ELM. It's spelled ELM. Autumn, because that's the season that is upon us. ELM Autumn, it's all one word, at RIT.edu.
Okay, ELM Autumn at RIT.edu.
Correct.
Does that mean that there's still ways to get into ongoing trials?
Yes.
Is that happening? Yeah.
Yes, there is. Yep. And if you email or call, you'll be asked a few questions to see if you have some major problems, why you wouldn't be able to be in the study. For example, if a person has already been diagnosed with diabetes, study is not open to those persons. And then if you are, then set up an appointment and you can come in and be tested to see if you actually have metabolic syndrome.
Is there any reason, Dr. Powell, is there any reason in any part of our lives, if we ever are eligible for clinical trials, for any ailments we have, is there any reason we should say no?
Oh, that's a loaded question, Evan.
It seems like it's always a good idea if you can get into trials to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's most important about clinical trials is that the reason we're doing the clinical trial is because we don't know which treatment is more effective. So you could be going into a clinical trial and spending all the time and effort getting allocated to one treatment, and it turns out that it doesn't help at all. On the other hand, it could be that you get into a treatment arm and it really does help. But you have to be willing to take that risk. One of the benefits of all clinical trials is that you will be evaluated more intensively than you would normally be evaluated in clinical practice. So even if you have a treatment that turns out not to work at all, we often catch other kinds of problems. We've caught early cancers, for example, when we've done evaluations in clinical trials. So we catch other things when people go through their various exams. But just to say once again, the reason we're doing a clinical trial is because we don't know what the best treatment is. And we've got two treatments that we're comparing. And you have to take the luck of the draw. You know, you may get a treatment that works, but then again, you may not. You may get a treatment that doesn't work. And that's the essence of clinical trials.
And the benefit of this one is that they're both treatments. It isn't like you go into a trial where you get a treatment versus absolutely nothing. And this one, no matter which group you go into, you get some treatment.
Well, it's wonderful to hear that patients like Pamela are doing well. And Pamela, as we get ready to let you go here, do you feel differently about your own future? I mean, do you feel in a sense like you understand your own health better than you have before?
Yes, I do. I do. And I feel like I have a little more control over my weight and how I live my life. I'm almost 70, and so I hope that that I continue with activities and can keep up with my grandkids
for
a lot longer.
It's beautiful. Pamela, your story, I think, is inspiring. And as someone who has been pretty successful in reversing your metabolic syndrome through these lifestyle changes, I think you're helping people by sharing it. Thank you for making time to be on the program today, Pamela.
Thank you.
That's Pamela,
for inviting me.
That's Pamela Rohde. Dr. Linda Powell from the Rush Medical College in Chicago. As we close here, I'm grateful for your time. Anything else people need to know about future trials or getting involved here?
You mean the ELM trial or any trial?
Basically, ELM or what you want people to know. I'll give you 30 seconds. What do you want people to know going forward here?
I think you should join the ELM trial. We've got two potential treatments, and it's all about lifestyle. And so, you know, if you think about a lifestyle that is unhealthy, it's like water going up against a dam. And in clinical practice, the only thing that we have right now is drugs. And so the drugs plug up the water in the dam. But as the water keeps coming forward, then the hole gets bigger and you need more and more drugs. So lifestyle is a fundamental risk factor. Try it out. It's fun.
Dr. Powell, thanks for being with us this hour.
Okay.
And great insight from Barbara Losey as well, from the Need Center at RT and the Wegman School of Health and Nutrition. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful conversation this hour. From the team at Connections, Rob Braden, engineer, Emma Ray Stein, production assistant, and Megan Mack, producer, who rang that bell at chemo today. I know a lot of people understand what Megan's been going through, and from the whole team here, we are cheering for her. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.